Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and today we're talking about the evolution of Free Code Camp with the teacher who founded Free Code Camp, Quincy Larson.
There was a lot of ambiguity, and there was a lot of fear that, like, maybe I just wasn't smart enough, I couldn't do it. Maybe that lack of math knowledge was really holding me back.
Quincy talks about creating the online learning resource he wished he had when he transitioned mid-career into tech, and how Free Code Camp has grown over time in community and content. After this. Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Saran.
So we've had you on the show in the past, but it's been a while. We had you back in 2015, and I know that there is so much stuff that's been happening with Free Code Camp. You guys have grown. You've built so many new products and new educational tools, free tools for the community. But let's do a little bit of a refresher. Tell us about what first got you into coding.
Absolutely. So I was a school director. I had a staff of teachers and students and administrators, and I wanted everybody to be able to spend more time together and less time, you know, inputting information into like government web forms and dealing with spreadsheets and everything. So I didn't have any sort of technical background, but I decided to start Googling around and like, there must be some better way we can do this, right? And sure enough, I was able to find some basic tools. Like I learned how to use, you know, Visual Basic in Excel and how to use this tool called AutoHotkey to like automate clicking on different forms and like keystrokes so that I could just like basically set up a bunch of tasks on my computer and then just walk away and come back and they would be done. And that way I was able to take on basically all the rote administrative work for the school over time. And it had a massive impact, and the students were happier, the teachers were happier, everybody was happier because we could focus on the things that mattered, which were, you know, person-to-person interactions and teaching, field trips, things like that. And so, like, the school prospered, and it gave me this impression that, like, hey, just one person who doesn't even know that much about coding can use these technologies to potentially dramatically improve the efficiency of an organization. And so I thought, well, what if we did this for other schools? Maybe I should create a big software tool to do that. And before I could do that, I needed to learn how to code properly. So I went on this basically 9-month period of just going to hackathons, going to tech talks, and spending as many waking hours as I could just in the command line, in the code editor, trying to build out projects and really understanding how to do software development.
So you are a career transitioner, like so many people in our community, like most of our community, I'd probably say. And you actually broke into tech in your 30s. Can you talk about what that journey was like, especially in that age group? You know, ageism is such a big problem in the tech industry. And I see people who are like, you know, 28 freaking out that it's too late for them, you know? So I'd love to hear kind of your journey and that transition breaking into tech.
I mean, even as a 30-year-old, I had it pretty easy because, you know, I'm a white male who's college educated and native English speaker. And like, I just brought so much privilege already. I mean, it seems silly and kind of absurd to say this, but like people almost projected upon me more confidence than I had because I was the guy with the beard and the glasses who looked like their dad, right? So they just presumed that I was like some experienced developer. And then when I sat down at the keyboard and tried to get basic things done, they'd be like, what's going on here? But the reality was like, I was basically like a 15-year-old developer in a 30-year-old developer's body or something like that. Right? That might be one way to look at it. So really, I didn't have it hard, and I'm not going to pretend I had it hard. Or it was just, it was kind of a lonely process learning to code and just using these free online resources and trying to get through them all. And that process really awakened me to the fact that, like, hey, coding communities, very powerful because they make people feel less isolated and linear curricula that help people figure out what they should learn in what sequence. Like, those are useful. So upon making those revelations, it seemed clear that, hey, we should have a community that is all arrayed around a single linear curriculum, and that can help solve a lot of the ambiguities that I faced learning to code.
What was it like for you emotionally to go through that journey? Were you confident? Were you nervous, optimistic? What was going through your head?
Well, there was a lot of ambiguity, and there was a lot of fear that, like, maybe I just wasn't smart enough. I couldn't do it. Maybe that lack of math knowledge was really holding me back, or maybe I just wasn't the kind of person who could sit in front of a command line and be told you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong repeatedly by interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
It was a struggle, but I had faith that I would eventually be able to, like, break through, because I'd seen other people do this, right? Like, I was not the first mid-career person to transition into tech. I had a friend, she was like 55. She was a school teacher, and she'd been able to, like, learn to code and go get a job at Apple.
Nice.
Right? Wow. As a software engineer. So it was like, I had plenty of people that I could, like, look up to and set, like, basically four instances that told me, like, I'm not crazy. People can run, you know, a 4-minute mile. People can eat 50 hot dogs and not just 25, right? Like, that's the Kobayashi. Sorry to, like, for a segue, but, like, basically, before he proved that you could eat, like, 50 hot dogs in a sitting, everybody was eating 25 and thinking that was the limit. But once he ate 50, everybody's like, oh, it's possible to eat 50. And all of a sudden, all these other people could eat 50 too. It was just a psychological barrier.
Yeah.
That's kind of a gross thing, by the way. But the 4-minute mile is a better example. Like, people thought it was impossible. Doctors were like, your heart will explode if you try to run a 4-minute mile.
Oh.
And then, you know, within a few years of somebody running a 4-minute mile, tons of high schoolers were running 4-minute miles.
That's so interesting. I feel like, you know, in my coding journey, especially in the early days when I was trying to make my way to a first job, it was a similar thinking that got me through as well, where when I encountered something that I thought was really hard that I couldn't figure it out, I would remind myself, someone has figured this out, right? Like, what I'm doing, especially, you know, in the early days when it's mostly CRUD apps, right? It's mostly forms. It's mostly just submitting and reading forms. Nothing too complicated. I kept saying to myself, this is something that millions of developers out there have figured out. They know how to do this. It is a known thing. I just haven't figured out how to do it yet. You know, it's not impossible. It's very much in the realm of possibility. It is a solved problem. I just have to get to the solution. And just knowing that it is doable and having so many examples of millions of developers who figured out that piece of code, that feature, that bug was a huge source of optimism for me. So I completely relate to that way of thinking of helping you get through. So that's awesome. So one thing I'm very curious about is FreeCodeCamp is a huge resource that's helped millions and millions of people learn how to code. But of course, when you were learning how to code, you didn't have FreeCodeCamp. So what did you use? What were the resources that helped you learn how to code when you transitioned over?
I used a lot of free online university courses. Stanford has, like, an algorithms course. They have a database course, which is excellent. I think that might still be available. I still think that's probably the best way to, like, learn about database design. I use just textbooks I found at the library, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend, but just coding along and doing programming assignments. A lot of those O'Reilly, like, Head First series, those were really good.
Oh, those are really good. I love the Head First series. Yeah.
Yeah. So just coding along with textbooks, which nowadays I would never encourage somebody to use a book when they could use a video and, like, see the code and, like, hear the person and, you know, reproduce exactly what they're doing if they wanted to, or better yet, like, clone a GitHub repo, code along at home. Like, I think that's just a way better way of learning. But the gold standard of learning is, like, interactive learning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was, like, Ruby koans, Python koans, mm-hmm, these things where you basically be in a command line. I use Project Euler a whole lot.
Yep.
Project Euler is just awesome. And we have implemented it both in JavaScript and in Rust, where you can basically go through with tests and solve them instead of just inputting a number into their web app.
Nice.
So solving Project Euler problems and then just building tons of projects. Like, every weekend I would go to a different hackathon. I was, you know, privileged enough to be in, you know, California during a huge renaissance in tech, when there was tons of money flowing into, like, companies and they could have lots of hackathons, and then we'd still be able to do that. So I would just take Amtrak up and down the coast and just go to different hackathons in different cities each weekend and stay in a hostel. And that process of doing a hackathon is essentially like product development condensed into a weekend where you have kind of conceptual work, you have the design of the application, you implement it, and then you pitch it. And so it's like doing startups every weekend, basically. So that was just a great way to jam a whole lot of learning and a whole lot of firsthand kind of like emotional experience. Like, oh, I completely bombed this code base, and now we're just going to have to give like a slide deck and kind of like show this mock-up essentially of what we would have built if I hadn't sucked so bad at coding, right? Like that sort of stuff. Like, I let my team down. Like you get all those kind of experiences condensed to a very short period of time. So across this 9 months of my life, I was able to work on tons of different teams, and I was able to get exposure to a lot of different concepts and resources. So I think hackathons, going to in-person events, that is absolutely like kind of a force multiplier, if you will, as far as like just giving you a ton of context within which you can take all the things you're learning from books and videos and kind of like contextualize it.
Yeah, that is such a great tip. How did you deal with, well, did you deal with the anxiety of a hackathon? I've always found hackathons to be very stressful. You know, there's so many people, everyone's kind of in a rush. You don't really know what skill level people are at. So naturally, I just assume everyone's an expert and, you know, I'm the only one that doesn't know what's going on. And it feels like a very kind of just an intense environment to put your coding skills into action. Did you have any of those feelings? And if so, how did you deal with them?
Oh, yeah. I was humbled repeatedly. And that's a good thing, frankly, because like the only thing worse than not being good at something is thinking you're good at something that you're not good at. And so just having that humility, it's a humility I try to carry with me even today, not just in trying to implement things, but like always assume the person you're talking to is smarter than you and that like all their decisions they have perfectly thought through. And if you don't understand what they're doing, there's a good chance that you just, you are missing something, right? Like always assume that the code you're running was thoughtfully designed and was sufficiently tested and that maybe you are the person introducing the noise into the system that's causing things not to work. And then start from there. If you start from that kind of humble perspective, I think you can learn a lot more. And often that will save you tons of time where you're just making presumptions about things that you shouldn't.
Absolutely. At what point in your coding journey did you go from, you know, I want to be a better developer, I want to develop these skills, to I need to start a free code camp?
So the original idea was I'll build some tools that will help people run schools like I do, that automate a lot of the grunt work of running a school. And after working as a software engineer for about a year, I realized, well, instead of doing that, if I just taught people all the things that I've learned over the 9 months that I spent learning and the year that I spent working as a software engineer on a team. By the way, the real learning starts once you get the job and you've got like a team that you're accountable to, got a large legacy code base. But like, if I could figure out a way to package a lot of that experience and knowledge that I had acquired over that period, then people could use that and learn how to do it. And then they would go build that school system. And I wouldn't have to build it. And they probably build it for hospitals and food banks and all kinds of other types of organizations. And so it very quickly became clear that like the way I learned to code was super suboptimal, but I couldn't see how I was doing things wrong necessarily. I mean, there were things that I was definitely doing wrong, but even if I had done everything perfect in hindsight, it still would have been harder than it needed to be. And so that was kind of the insight that caused like, oh, I need to create technology education tools, essentially, like self-learning tools. And so I iterated through a lot of them. Most people never cared. Like I'd be able to like hand somebody an iPad and say, hey, go through this workflow and like, what do you think of this? And they'd be like, oh, it's great. And then they would never return to the website. And so that was like a very clear indication that I wasn't going quite where people needed me to go with the tools. And then, you know, Free Code Camp was basically a result of stripping away a whole lot of the excess features and just getting to the core of what people already knew they wanted to learn, which was JavaScript. I mean, that's the skill that everybody needed to be able to get a job in 2014. So that, why not just focus on that instead of all the additional stuff that, you know, more senior engineers might need? Or, you know, like I'm not going to teach people how to do DevOps and stuff like that. Right. I'm going to just focus on writing curricula to teach people basic web development because that's the low hanging fruit.
And at the time, what did you envision that Free Code Camp would look like? What would it look like in your head?
So we wanted to have a linear curriculum that didn't have any electives, because I think electives are bad.
Okay.
If you go to medical school, everybody learns basically the same thing, and then they specialize through residency.
Right, program. Right.
And historically, if you went to university, if you're one of the lucky 1% of people in the most prosperous place in the world in 1900, London, if you were wealthy enough to go to university, everybody learned the same kind of canon of knowledge, like Greek mm-hmm. and Latin and history and rhetoric and logic yeah, sure. and mathematics and stuff like that, right? Like, mm-hmm. so it was only like more recently that these electives creeped in and we started giving our 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds the task of trying to decide what they should learn without just saying like, hey, actually, we know that you probably should learn this and this is useful, right? And part of it, like maybe somewhat skeptically, just thinks that like it just contributed to this kind of end state where you can actually go to university and you can get a degree and still have trouble getting a job because maybe you didn't learn the right things, you know, quote unquote, right things for what the job market is looking for. That was a very concerted decision. Like, I want a linear progression of skills. That way people don't get caught in some sort of weird prerequisite circular dependency, or they don't go all the way through all this stuff without learning something essential. So that was a big part of it. The other part was I wanted the community to be involved and I wanted it to not be a lonely process. So we got the forum. We have a few chat servers. I was like live coding on Twitch pretty regularly for about 2 years and just trying to like be like, hey, I can do it and I think you can do it. But we were all working through that same curriculum. So I would just say community and curriculum. That's what I wanted it to look like.
Is your company looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. The dev community is the go-to destination for developers to learn, connect, and support each other. You can share your message with the 15 million developers that visit every single month by using our powerful native advertising platform. To learn more, visit dev.to/advertise. So FreeCodeCamp launched in 2014. Can you talk about some of the biggest ways that it has evolved in the last 8 years?
It originally was just a list of resources, mostly like Stanford courses and MIT courses. And we started building software that would allow us to teach these interactively in the browser client side.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we created thousands of coding challenges. So the curriculum became this interactive thing, which, you know, I think is good. I think interactive is better than passive. And the more interactive and the tighter feedback loop, that is something good that you should strive toward. So that was like the first version of the curriculum. The second version of the curriculum was like kind of even more granular. And now we can do everything inside of VS Code, for example. Like you can actually learn SQL in the command line right inside VS Code. And you can start up, you know, a Postgres database and write to it. And it'll run the tests against the state of your SQL database, or, you know, it'll run the tests against the state of your, you know, Git working tree. So we're just increasingly trying to make the curriculum more interactive. And I think that that's where we ultimately want, is for like every single moment that you're on FreeCodeCamp going through the core curriculum, maybe we're drip feeding you like one or two sentences worth of concepts, and then you're immediately turning and applying those with your fingers on the keyboard. The other big developments, we have a publication that has about 8,000 articles. I've wrote about 400 or 500 of those myself. Not all of them are attributed to me. Some of them are just attributed to FreeCodeCamp. At this point, we've had like 600 or 700 people, developers from the field, who have basically come and written tutorials that we published there. So that's like a pretty good corpus of knowledge, and everything is run by our editorial team and it's maintained. And then one of the things we did pretty early on was we created a YouTube channel. And for the first 4 or 5 years, we'd be like thrilled if 100 people or 1,000 people would like watch a given video that we created. But recently that started to take off. And now I believe FreeCodeCamp has the biggest programming focused channel on YouTube.
How big is it now?
5.2 million subscribers.
Wow, that's amazing. How big is FreeCodeCamp, the organization, like in the videos, I know that it's not just you teaching, right? It's other people who are teaching as well. You have the blog contributors, you have code contributors. I believe you also have community managers. How big does the organization of Free Code Camp today?
Yeah, so I believe we have like 32 people.
That's not that big.
Yeah, we do have like 90 servers. So a lot of it is like people managing and teaching through instructional design and through software. Mm. So like, as you and I talk, there might be like 3,000 or 4,000 people like using freecodecamp.org, but I'm able to talk to you here and I'm not in a classroom somewhere like talking directly with students. So we're kind of teaching through instructional design and that works pretty well. And then, yeah, the team is mostly teachers, classroom teachers. Some of them would be like, you know, creators on YouTube or authors. But they kind of have this background in basically synthesizing knowledge and sharing it. And then, of course, we have a few people that are just totally focused on software engineering. But even them, like, I try to get them involved in teaching.
I remember when I first came across Free Code Camp many, many years ago, well, basically around the time when it started. And, you know, it was a lot of, you know, it's called Free Code Camp because it's going to be free forever. And this is going to be, you know, free and accessible. And I remember reading that and going, once this thing takes off, we'll see if it's still free. I was very skeptical. And it really has taken off. It's grown so much in the last under a decade, in just the last 8 years. And you reach so many people. Why is it still free? Have you ever been tempted to turn it into something that can generate, you know, profit, generate real revenue? Has that ever, you know, something that's crossed your mind as you've seen it grow and kind of blow up in the community?
Well, I'm kind of idealistic in the sense that I do believe that education can be free, that, you know, given the resources, and it's not that many resources. I mean, we spend so much money on just building like a single aircraft carrier. Education could absolutely be free in the United States. It could be subsidized by the state. It could be subsidized by employers. So my ideal is like every facet of Free Code Camp will be free. There are lots of ways we could build stuff that would have a higher marginal cost per learner. Mm. We just don't build it because it's just like, okay, if it can't be free, we're not going to bother with it.
Interesting.
And so first of all, we're a donor-supported 501c3 nonprofit. We can't be owned. I don't own any equity in Free Code Camp. I relinquished my equity when we converted to nonprofit, like very early on. That was always the plan. And as a result, there are a lot of restrictions on what we can and cannot do. Mm. But if you give a donation to Free Code Camp, you can deduct that from your taxes. Mm-hmm. And corporations can deduct grants that they give to Free Code Camp from their taxes. So we are very blessed, and we have about 8,000 people around the world who give $5 or so to Free Code Camp each month. And that is a decent like starting point for our operational budget. We work with organizations like, we work with Google, MongoDB, New Relic, Sneak is a security like DevSecOps tool. We're kind of stringing together a lot of grants combined with donor support, combined with like, you know, alumni giving large gifts and things like that. Mm. And my hope is that we can get to a point where we can just continue to function and grow as more and more people go through Free Code Camp. You know, Michael Bloomberg donated $1 billion to Johns Hopkins University. $1 billion, right? Like with that, they could put that in the market just in a, you know, stock index or whatever, like the S&P 500 index. Mm-hmm. And they could basically generate maybe like 8% a year historically. Mm-hmm. And it can basically serve as part of an endowment. And that's how universities operate. They have these endowments. And that generates enough interest on the principal that they can just operate off of that. Mm-hmm. Johns Hopkins never has to charge a student tuition again. Like they can basically operate at their current level without ever charging tuition again, based off of that Michael Bloomberg gift. Mm. And that's just one alumni, right? So like, I have to think like Free Code Camp, like we're kind of farming Michael Bloomberg's in the sense that if even a few people go through Free Code Camp and are, you know, profoundly successful, maybe they start a big startup or something like that, right? Then their gifts can basically subsidize Free Code Camp for potentially millions of people.
So I want to talk about the curriculum and the content over the years. You said that, you know, when you first started Free Code Camp, you were kind of trying different things and you landed on JavaScript, and JavaScript being the thing you needed to know in 2014. What do you need to know today? What kinds of things does Free Code Camp teach? What kinds of tutorials are the most popular? What's changed since then?
So this is a great question, because a lot of people think that tech is like constantly in flux and that like the tools that are used are like, things are changing so fast, I don't even know what to learn. That's a common lament that I hear from people. And what I tell them is, generally, you just want to focus on mature technologies, because lots of companies are using WordPress. Lots of companies are using, you know, Python, Django, or they're using Node.js, or they're using some other web development framework. Even if it's like 10 years old, I mean, there are still systems using COBOL, right? We published this course with IBM on COBOL development. Don't sweat the new technologies. Don't spend all day on Hacker News like or R programming. Like, oh my gosh, there's so many new tools coming online. How am I ever going to learn these? Please don't thrash like that. The big technologies that you should really learn, the fundamentals, are mostly stuff that's been around for 20 years. And I'll just go ahead and rattle off what I personally encourage people to learn.
Absolutely.
The big core are like JavaScript, Python, HTML, CSS, Git, Linux, and SQL. If you learn those technologies, you are equipped to do probably like 80% of the entry-level software developer jobs in the United States, and probably abroad too. And if you know Python program, if you know Django, or if you know Node.js with JavaScript, you can easily learn other development frameworks, whichever development framework they want you to learn, right? If you have time to learn C or like some lower level language, that can be really useful too. Rust is pretty powerful. We're creating a ton of resources around Rust. But again, at the end of the day, just learn a scripting language well, learn a database well, learn a full stack web development framework well, and you're golden. At least for your first job. Like have a very strong general background and then specialize on the job. A lot of people come to me and they're like, Quincy, I want to be a DevOps, or I want to do, you know, machine learning, specifically this type of machine learning. Like they'll come to me with this extremely specific thing that they want to do. And I'm like, that's awesome. That sounds like a good third or fourth job. Let's start with some full stack web development is probably the broadest category of developer jobs. And then maybe from there you can move into the mobile team, or you can move into the machine learning team. But like all this stuff rests on knowing how databases work, knowing how web servers work.
So I'm curious about the different types of tutorials and educational content that has worked or maybe not worked over the years. As you said, you have YouTube videos, you've got the interactive, you know, coding curriculum, you've got tons of exercises. You also launched a video game recently. Tell me a little bit about the different formats, structures, the way you think about educational content, and if some perform better than others.
So the first thing I want to tell you is anytime you spend learning, regardless of how you're learning, that is a positive, however marginal it may seem. Like I listen to, thousands of hours of podcasts on double speed. Like I've listened to pretty much like certainly up to 2015. I think I listened to every single episode of Codenewbie. I listen to pretty much every episode of like the Changelog, for example. And there are tons of other great podcasts on software engineering, on programming. Just hearing people talk about technology, it steeps you in it, and it kind of gives you this mental framework to understand why things are important and like what things are important and how things get used in the real world. So don't ever feel like you're wasting your time if you're learning, right? Like there are always little things you can do to optimize further. But never beat yourself up like, oh, you know, I didn't have time to sit down at the keyboard today, but like I just listened to, you know, a podcast while I was going for a walk or while I was washing the dishes or something. Like that is still learning, and that should still be commended. I do think that interactive learning is the most bang for buck in terms of like learning you're going to get for time. If you're spending time building a project, especially if you have like a test suite thing and you're not just like, hey, I want to build a to-do list and it's going to do this. Like if you actually have the test suite already there and it's telling you whether you're making progress towards your goal or not, that kind of guided learning can be extremely useful. And if you look at the Free Code Camp curriculum, especially like the newest two certifications, which are the updated responsive web design and the relational databases certification, Those are both designed, like every single thing is learned within the context of a project, and there's always tests for every single step. Like there's never a point where you're like, did I do this right? No, like you will know if you did it right because the tests are saying you did it right and you can move to the next step. Mm. So that kind of learning that keeps you on kind of a golden path and keeps you plowing forward, where, you know, a teacher has concertedly designed the progression of like, okay, you're going to build this and then you're going to build this and then you're going to go back and you're going to reuse this thing you used 20 minutes ago to further reinforce your understanding of that so you don't forget it. Like that kind of learning, I think, is the gold standard. And that's what we really emphasize with Free Code Camp. Like a vast majority of those 30 people that are working on stuff, like most of that time goes into that interactive curriculum.
Mm. So tell me about this video game. You have a Learn to Code RPG that launched December of 2021, I believe. And it's a visual novel, video game, learning computer science concepts, tons of games and quizzes and all kinds of fun things in it. Where did that idea come from? And why did you decide to build a video game?
So I am a longtime believer in video games, GWAPs, games with a purpose. I mean, my kids learn so much through games. I've got two young kids. I've got a four-year-old and a six-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I love just dropping them into an environment, even if it's something kind of silly, like I think it's called like Where's My Water or something like that, or Cut the Rope, like these old iOS games. Mm-hmm. Those are really fun because they do get you problem solving and they do get you thinking about like physics systems and things like that. And even if it seems like silly and unuseful outside of the game, it's still really fun. But what if you inject it into a relatively fun game format, like a role-playing game or a visual novel? What if you projected on that, like the actual kind of like meta experience of being, you know, somebody who's living with their parents and who had a friend who got a job in tech and like, I want to work in tech. Mm-hmm. Maybe I can be like her. And so the game puts you in the shoes of that person. But the default character name, you can change it, is Lydia. And she's basically just hanging out with her cat and working as a barista during the day and going to hackerspaces and hanging out and trying to make friends, trying to build her network, trying to grok the mm-hmm. many, many different concepts that you need to understand like how tech works, like DevOps concepts, security concepts. And so the initial storyline, which is only about 2 hours of gameplay, is basically her trying to get her first job. And mm-hmm. we have a whole lot of additional characters that we're working on and additional storylines where she's going to go into security. She's going to go into DevOps. She's going to go into QA. Basically, she works in all these different tech roles. And we've got all these characters pulled out of like Silicon Valley history and, you know, just popular culture that she's going to interact with as she ultimately like, you know, builds confidence in her skills and like creates like a freelance agency or potentially like a product-based startup. So it'll eventually hopefully be like a 20, 30-hour game.
Mm.
The goal is for people to be able to visualize, okay, like I'm in this village in India or in Nigeria and like I'm so far removed from tech, but how do I understand this? How do I approach this? And eventually we do hope to have like a Nigerian edition of the game and an Indian edition of the game, just to be able to imagine themselves going through this process. Because one of the problems is a lot of people just, they can't even visualize themselves going through this process. It just seems completely alien, mm-hmm. learning to code and going and getting a job as a software developer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want to touch on that a little bit more because I remember having this conversation with you many years ago. And I remember you saying, basically conveying how important it was to you that there are more international resources for learning to code. And that, you know, when you think about the developer community and learn to code community, I remember you saying that a lot of it feels very US centric, feels very, you know, native English speaker centric. And I feel like Free Code Camp over the years has put in a lot of effort in building real communities and real networks in many different parts of the world, not just the US. Tell me a little bit more about that journey. How did Free Code Camp become an international organization?
Just by virtue of being on the internet, like everybody's kind of international in the sense that, like, you know, packets reach Mexico City just as fast as they reach Palo Alto, right? We very early decided, like, hey, we want to localize into French. We want to localize into Spanish. We want to localize into Arabic. And it was just a question of like, the resources. How could we do that? Because it's a lot of work to translate tons of articles, to translate a pretty large curriculum into these different languages. I mean, of course, we could just put them through Google Translate. And we did that initially. And we're like, hey, these translations kind of suck. Like, they need a lot of work. Like, no shade on Google Translate. I mean, it enables, like, everyday people that don't speak a lot of these different languages to be able to understand.
Right.
Like, hey,
right.
What is this thing that this person just tweeted at me? Or what mm-hmm. if somebody just emailed me? Like, I can throw it in Google Translate and figure it out, right? But the process of, like, localizing, it goes beyond just language. There's culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things, as we have more resources, we're spending an outsized amount of our resources just on trying to make FreeCodeCamp more accessible, like not just accessible in traditional ways, like this is in your language, but actually appealing to people mm. in other cultures.
So there is a phenomenon that people love to call tutorial hell, which is, you know, just when people get stuck doing tutorial after tutorial and not actually moving forward in their careers, not really making any progress. How do you advise people avoid this phenomenon? How do we escape or avoid entirely tutorial hell?
As long as you're building projects and not just doing the nth, you know, beginner's tutorial on XYZ, I do feel that there's a risk of, like, overdoing the fundamental stuff. And there's this gap between, there's just a ton of beginner resources available, and then there's really advanced resources like academic articles and conference tech talks and stuff like that, right? So how do you bridge from beginner to upper intermediate advanced, right? And I don't think tutorials are necessarily how you get there. I think it's building projects, getting your first job. A lot of people, I think, spend too much time building their skills, not enough time building out their networks, not enough time building out their reputations, which I think are equally important to get a job. So I would encourage people to contribute to open source. That's one way you can build your reputation and your network at the same time. I would encourage people to build, you know, in public. And by creating that Twitter account, by creating that blog, you have the potential to help other people, and, like, you're producing. You know, you're not just consuming, you're also producing. Just know that, like, tutorials are not going to get you a job. They're not going to walk you down and have you shake hands with the hiring manager and get your desk and all that stuff, right? Like, you are going to need to be out there scrambling, even as somebody who's good at coding, like, to really have the willpower to push through ambivalence in the job market and push through rejections and just keep applying. Because I would say anybody who's kind of spinning their wheels and not actively applying for jobs, like, it's totally cool for the first year or so if you're just trying to get your bearings. But, like, if you wait until you feel ready to start applying for jobs, you've waited too long. You should absolutely go ahead and start applying. And a lot of people would say, I don't want to blow all my chances.
Interesting.
There are lots of potential employers out there. And it's not like there's, like, some underground network of, like, employers who, like, all gossip and say, oh, don't hire so-and-so. Right. They bomb this interview. Like, people are busy. They don't really care. Like, you might be surprised that you apply to the same company 6 months from your first application. They have no idea who you are. Don't even realize you've applied before, right? Like, people are just busy. So I think the tutorial hell, I think that's more of a symptom of people just waiting too long to get into the job search.
Coming up next, Quincy talks about what the future of FreeCodeCamp holds. After this. How has the job search and the job market in general changed over the last 8 years when you hear stories about people in your community trying to, you know, interview, break into the career today and go through that job application process compared to what it was like back in 2014? What are some big changes you've seen?
So the pandemic has changed so much.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's changed a lot of the balance of power in the labor market. People have had time to reflect and realize that, hey, I'm not just some cog in a machine. I'm a human being. And I think that it's reasonable for me to be able to not be on call all the time or not to have to work, like, ridiculous death march hours, right? Like, if you go to a company and everybody's grinding and crunching, it's probably because the management doesn't know what the heck they're doing. And they're probably not sufficiently, like, planning things, or they just don't care about the employees and their mental health, which should be a big red flag. Mm-hmm. So I think people are starting to wise up to their potential value and what they're bringing to the table, and they're starting to advocate for themselves more. Mm. And I think that's profoundly positive. And I think the changes that are taking place right now are similarly important to like when we got, you know, 40-hour work weeks and weekends and stuff like that. And I think the big thing is like, hey, there are legitimate reasons for me needing to be in an office with a whole bunch of other people. And there are also plenty of situations where I can just use modern telecommunications and other technology to be able to get my job done while I stay home with my kids. Mm-hmm. So I think that's been a big, big change. Like, I still think you're going to be applying to dozens, hundreds of jobs potentially before you can get an offer. Mm-hmm. That hasn't changed. Employers, at least in the US, still are risk averse. And I think their risk aversion is largely warranted in the sense that, like, if you do make a bad hire, it's like not only do you have to start the entire process over again, but you also have probably spent a lot of time training somebody who's not going to be doing work. So you've lost time in terms of product development or in terms of other things. You've potentially demoralized the team that you're having to like part ways with somebody.
Right, right.
I'm not trying to, you know, excuse the very opaque, frustrating nature of trying to apply for a job. Mm-hmm. I do think the rise in remote work and, you know, asynchronous work where you don't have to work certain hours, you can just get the work done. And it doesn't really matter like what time of day you're doing it. So you're able to, you know, go to the gym in the morning and you're able to have lunch with your family and stuff like that. Like, I think that those are all very positive developments.
What have been some of the outcomes of Free Code Camp over the last 8 years? Share some kind of numbers. Feel free to brag about, you know, the number of resources you all have created, people you've helped, people who've come through, that sort of thing.
The number of people who are now working as software developers who did not necessarily need to go back and get a second bachelor's degree, you know, interrupt their lives and their work. Like, the dream scenario is somebody can keep working their job and keep providing for the family, and then nights and weekends learn some additional skills, or, you know, and apply for jobs or potentially transition within their own company. I had lots of success stories of people going from, for example, the sales department or the service department, IT department, to, you know, the developer bullpen, or being able to work as a software engineer in an organization without having to risk a lot of debt or risk a lot of time. So that has been one thing we're very proud of. And our LinkedIn alumni network is about 800,000 followers, several hundred thousand of whom have like listed certifications they've earned through Free Code Camp. I'm also very proud of the fact that we've localized into many world languages. Like, it's available in Spanish, it's available in Portuguese, both simplified and traditional Chinese, Japanese, Ukrainian. We've got a lot of world languages that we've successfully localized Free Code Camp into. It's going to be available in Arabic. We also have just a ton of tutorials. Every year we give out the top contributor award, and it's just such a joy to be able to go and look at all the work that's been done over the course of the year and recognize those volunteer contributors. I think, like, if I had to like crunch it down to like one numeric fact that I'm most proud of, is we did 2 billion minutes of learning in 2021.
Wow.
2 billion minutes. That's the equivalent of about 4,000 years.
Oh my goodness.
So that means that at any given point, there were about 4,000 people using Free Code Camp, right? Wow. During that year.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And our budget was, I think it was like $700,000, $800,000. It was not a lot of money for considering. So we have a very outsized impact. Mm-hmm, and so if you give money to Free Code Camp, every dollar you give to Free Code Camp essentially translates into about 50 hours worth of learning by people around the world. So we're just incredibly capital efficient as an NGO. And that's something I'm very proud of, because we're very careful about how we use technology. And because we're really focused on what people actually are trying to learn, we're trying to go where people are. We're trying to go into the languages they're already speaking. We're trying to teach the skills that the job market is already demanding. People are going straight from like Indeed.com or LinkedIn to Free Code Camp to learn the skills that they see job postings requiring.
What do you attribute that growth to? Because, you know, over the last 8 years, there are tons of resources. A lot of them are paid, but a lot more are free. And there's a lot of tutorials, so many YouTube channels, so many, you know, different types of curricula that have popped up, teaching people how to code. So many Twitch streamers is a market that's really blossomed over the last couple of years. What do you think made Free Code Camp so successful?
I think a lot of it has to do with just, we're all learners. Mm-hmm. So there's that empathy, right? Like we're not purporting to be this expert descendant from on high, like from the ivory tower, who's going to show you the best definitive way to do something, right? Like it's just a chorus of people that are like, hey, a few years ago, I was where you are. And here's what I've learned for getting past this specific thing, or like using this specific tool, right? I think a lot of it is just that we are a free resource. We are a nonprofit, like a scrappy little nonprofit, right? And I think people relate to that, and it doesn't, we're not trying to like browbeat them, or we're not trying to build up our own credibility. We're just trying to help them.
Mm. What does the next 8 years of Free Code Camp look like?
That's a great question. If I could say the next 12 years.
Sure.
That's about how long we think it'll take, but we're transitioning into an accredited 4-year university program.
Wow.
So that is a very long, expensive process, mm-hmm. that, you know, dealing with accreditors and making sure that we meet their stringent requirements. That's a massive undertaking. And the first step, of course, is just to work with existing universities and try to get them to accept more of Free Code Camp as university credit. We're working with some potential partners on that. But the notion of being able to go to a relatively inexpensive state university that's already regionally accredited and transfer in a year, 2 years, 3 years worth of coursework from Free Code Camp and only have to do a year at that university, that dramatically increases the access. It dramatically reduces the cost, both time and money-wise, for, you know, an adult learner who's just trying to finish their degree. Like in this country, we've got a lot of people who have debt from university, but they didn't actually finish university. They don't have the degree. And so they're not actually getting the benefit from that degree program. We'd love to make it so it's relatively easy for people to go back and finish that degree, or people who just never even went to college. By the way, there are tons of people on the Free Code Camp team who never went to university. Hmm. Like if they want to go get a CS degree, they can get it. Like they'll be able to get it for Free Code Camp, and they'll be able to get it for free through Free Code Camp.
What does that mean in terms of your opinion of the role, the importance of a university degree, specifically a computer science degree, in the future? You know, I feel like there's been this never-ending conversation about how useful is it? Do you really need it? I feel like over the years, a lot of companies have been a little bit more open-minded, a little bit more flexible of, you know, looking for people who have the degree and accepting people who come from boot camps, non-traditional backgrounds. Where do you see kind of the role of secondary education, university education in the future of learning to code?
I think we're going to continue to have, you know, credential inflation, which, yeah, there's a lot of talk in tech that like increasingly large companies say they don't care about degrees. I mean, I'd be astounded if like two equal candidates, one who had a degree and one didn't, like if they would ever side with the one who didn't.
That's true.
You'd
yeah,
have to perform in other areas to compensate for not having that. I'm not saying that like, oh, you're doomed if you don't have a degree, you should go back to college. I don't generally tell people to go back to school if it's going to involve incurring significant debt. If you can go to community college and get a degree, like get on the path to articulating to a state school and getting a proper 4-year degree from that, like I think that's good. But I'm not suggesting somebody who's already mid-career as a software developer needs to go back to college. And I'm not suggesting that anybody should feel inferior because they didn't go to university. Mm-hmm. Like the reality is, it's not your fault that universities are so freaking expensive all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. I was very privileged and fortunate. Like when I went to university, you could actually go with just working like a full-time job and paying tuition. And like my tuition at my very inexpensive state school in Oklahoma was about $1,000 a semester, or about $3,000 a year. Wow. And I'm like, I'm 41 years old. So I went in like 2000 to 2003, I think it were the years that I was attending undergrad. But You know, the inflation in education is out of control, and there's no reason for it. I don't believe that universities are justified in charging the absurd amounts that they are. And I believe that a whole bunch of ultra low cost degree providers or free degree providers will have the positive effect of bringing down the cost of all but the most prestigious degree programs. Like if you're, you know, Harvard, if you're Columbia, maybe you can justify charging what you do, but not if you're just some like local liberal arts university or liberal arts college, or if you're, you know, just some state school that's not like super duper prestigious, like UMichigan maybe could charge a lot, UT Austin, UC Berkeley. But I think most state schools can't justify the amounts of money they're spending, and they just need to figure out how to make education less expensive.
Okay, so in the future, we're going to create the Free Code Camp University, make it an official degree. I'm curious, where do you see the content going in terms of what you're actually teaching? You know, we talked about JavaScript, Python, Linux, some of these, you know, constants, been popular for many years, still being popular today. When you think about the future of the content and the curriculum roadmap, I'm curious how you see that changing over time. I remember seeing that one of your alumni donated $1 million, which is pretty exciting for you all to develop a Web3 curriculum. Where do you see kind of the future of content going, especially with getting so much support from alumni and wanting to, you know, of course, be cutting edge and, you know, kind of stay on top of technology?
Yeah, we're very excited to be building like this totally blockchain agnostic Web3 curriculum. As far as other topics that we're really excited about, like continuing to focus on scientific computing and machine learning. We're working on a massive expansion to our curriculum, our core curriculum, that will focus a lot more on Python development. We're going to cover all of undergraduate engineering mathematics interactively right inside a Jupyter notebook with Python. That includes statistics, it includes calculus, linear algebra, and then also lots of different types of machine learning, data analysis. So you're going to learn neural networks, you're going to learn transfer learning, supervised and unsupervised learning. Basically, a whole lot of really advanced stuff that maybe only a few tens of thousands of people in the world right now actually use day to day. But the beauty of the Free Code Camp curriculum is it starts with front-end development, and you learn HTML, CSS, JavaScript really well. Then it goes to full-stack development. So you can get a job, in theory, after you just finished two or three certifications. And in practice, a lot of people just do that, and then they come back and they learn more as they go.
How do you decide what direction to go in? You know, like for example, I can see with coding going kind of the more machine learning mathematical route, which it sounds like you guys are doing. But I can also see kind of going a very different direction where it's more maybe user interface, design, kind of, you know, that side of things, maybe going into product development. There's so many different branches you could have picked. What made you pick the direction you're going in?
We want to focus on things that can be taught interactively. Product design and things like that, they're like a lot more subjective. Okay. And it's a lot harder to have a deterministic test suite to tell you whether you're doing right
or
you're doing
something as abstract as that. Yeah.
To some extent, like what we can teach interactively is always going to be bounded by what we can test.
So after running your own online bootcamp for 8 years, I'm curious, what is your take on other coding bootcamps, particularly paid ones? I feel like the, you know, the coding bootcamp landscape has changed so much in the last 8 years where, you know, when I did my coding bootcamp back in 2013, it was relatively hot. It was, you know, the way to go. And then over time, a lot of them shut down, a lot of them consolidated, a lot of them switched to kind of a more enterprise focus. Then a lot of online stuff kind of popped up. And, you know, I feel like people have always had kind of mixed review. And then there's also like the whole ISA payment model, which is very controversial. What's your take on kind of the state of paid coding bootcamps today?
I wrote a guide maybe 2 years ago about like how to identify a good coding bootcamp. And I do believe there are lots of programs out there that are good, but there are also a lot of programs that I would describe as predatory, who are basically over-promising and under-delivering, sometimes in very spectacular ways. My general, like if you don't have 25 minutes to read my giant, like it's called like the coding bootcamp handbook or something like that. If you don't have time to read that, like the crux of the advice is like, see if you can talk to some of the alumni, find them on LinkedIn, ask them what they thought of the program. Just ask them, would you do this again? Like, would you spend all this money to do this program again if you had the choice knowing what you know now? And if they're like, yeah, then like, hey, that sounds like a pretty good program. Like, I would talk to several people, by the way, to get kind of like a consensus. But yeah, like, I think if you do that, like, coding boot camps are an accelerant. They can accelerate your ability to get a job. They are not a substitute for spending a huge amount of time coding. And most of them will kind of, like, the good ones will probably expect you to have already, you know, made some progress with your own learning. Very few of them, I think, if they're going to take you in as a total newcomer to programming, then they should probably be telling you, like, hey, this is just the first part, and it's going to take you several months to get a job after this, and you're going to have to continue learning beyond this program. If they're candid about those sorts of things, like, that's kind of going against their own sales pitch. So that would be, like, definitely, like, you know, a point toward their them being, you know, candid. Because the ideal strategy, if you're a boot camp and you just want to make money, is to just basically tell everybody, like, hey, we'll do it all. You're going to be great. You're going to get an amazing salary. Everything's going to be gravy, right? And not actually tell you how much work it is. And like, one red flag I would say is, not just for boot camps, for anybody, but if anybody says, like, programming is easy, programming is not easy. It is not easy to learn to code. And if anybody tells you that, they are almost certainly trying to sell you something. So I would just be skeptical of people who make it out to be not a big deal. Or getting a job. Getting a job is not easy. There are very talented software engineers that still struggle to get good jobs, right? To still get offers that they think are, you know, commensurate with what their time is worth.
What is your biggest piece of advice for people who are trying to learn how to code today? Someone who maybe listened to this episode and said, okay, today's the day. I'm going to change my career. I'm going to take that leap of faith. I'm going to really focus on learning to code. What advice do you have for them?
My advice, like, has not really changed in 7 years, because I just genuinely believe this is probably the most actionable advice. Try to code at least a little bit every day, even if it's just like, oh, it's already like 11 p.m. and I've got to go to work in the morning. Just see if you can crack open the code editor and, like, you know, solve some project Euler problems. I mean, not some, they're all monumental undertakings. Just do a few challenges on Free Code Camp. Yeah. It's like, you know, Code Wars, or like, there's lots of coding challenges sites. Just try to get something done every day. And I would try to avoid taking any time off. 100 days of code is great for this, actually, because it'll kind of establish like a routine. 100 days is long enough to establish a routine. So there's the 100 days of code hashtag. I would check that out. My second piece of advice is, like, try not to work completely in isolation. Try to, like, meet other people who are working as software developers. Even though there's a global pandemic that continues to rage, like, at least join some Discord servers or talk to some people on Twitter. Just knowing other people that are kind of in the proverbial trenches with you, like, also trying to accomplish the mission of getting good jobs in tech or promotions, like building things, that is just so inspiring. And if you get a chance to go to, like, hackathons, I think hackathons are really formative, and those are a great way to, like, have fun and get kind of used to the rigors. So again, just to recapitulate, try to code a little every day, try to code with other people, hang out with people that code.
Well, thank you again so much, Quincy, for joining us.
Thank you for the thoughtful questions, Saran.
This show is produced and mixed by Levi Sharp. You can reach out to us on Twitter at CodeNewbies or send me an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Join us for our weekly Twitter chats. We've got our Wednesday chats at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and our weekly coding check-in every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. For more info on the podcast, check out www.codenewbie.org/podcast. Thanks for listening. See you next week.